Welcome to the online course on the Nibbana Sermons 12 to 22 by Bhikkhu Katakurunda Nyanananda, a course hosted in collaboration between the Numata Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of Hamburg and the Barrett Center for Buddhist Studies in Massachusetts. And today we will be looking at sermon number 14. But before getting into that, I wanted to take up a few things from the online forum, the very interesting discussions that happened in relation to sermon number 13. And I'm not really able to do justice to all the things that were said, so I'm just picking out a few things, very few actually. A thing that also struck me in the last sermon and that several participants commented on is this statement made by Venerable Nyanananda that when one says the river flows, it does not mean that there is a river quite apart from the act of flowing. That quite beautifully brings out a central point that he made in that last sermon. And it is a testimony to what in the words of Robert Harwood, that the Venerable Nyanananda, in explaining the true thrust of the suttas as compared to the commentaries on them, is actually speaking from personal experience. That his personal experience illuminates the true meaning of the suttas. Then Hedwig Krensch brought up something that is still related to this article on the luminous mind. And she's basically, well, I read part of what she said. Could it be that although there is some wrong imagining in an eternally tinged citta or bhavanga citta, it is still possible to progress on the path because the confidence in the law of cause and effect and retributions of good and bad deeds is also there, maybe even stronger than this citta false view. And with stream entry, this wrong belief in citta or original purity of the mind, is it abandoned or does this belief stay until arahanthood? Yeah, it's a very interesting but also a little bit challenging question. So I have a first try at saying something and then we see what others will say in the ensuing discussion. One thing I think is the bhavanga citta is not really something eternal. That's a very beautiful and helpful article by Gethin on this whole bhavanga citta that clarifies it a lot. But I think it is just an attempt and a very meaningful attempt within the context of Theravada theory to make sense of continuity in the face of the doctrine of momentariness. So it is something that continues as a process. I don't think it is ever seen as eternal in itself, and which in a way explains how there can be something like memory, which is difficult to explain when we see all mental events as arising and passing away every moment. So I don't think that such ideas and meditation practices informed by these ideas are necessarily having wrong view or no longer capable to lead to a stream entry. The other thing, what I covered in the last part of my article, this idea of original pure mind. And this is really prevalent in practice traditions, which are based on, I think, a somewhat different conception of awakening, or in fact, for these traditions, I would probably prefer to use the term enlightenment rather than awakening. And this is the whole trajectory at the background of the Bodhisattva path. And this idea that the goal of practice is Buddhahood, and one should be even avoiding stream entry in order to be able to achieve that final goal of Buddhahood. From the perspective of a practitioner, at least in the middle period Buddhism, or practitioner of the Bodhisattva path, stream entry would be almost like an accident, better to be avoided, because it would cut short the possibility of becoming a Buddha in the future. And so when we operate within that worldview, which I think is a valid worldview and needs to be recognized as such, I'm not in any way wanting to dismiss it. It's just that the type of realization that meditation practice is meant to bring about is not necessarily the same as for somebody who works from an early Buddhist viewpoint or within the Theravada Vipassana community. And so I think this needs to be understood on its own terms, rather than using the ideas and concepts from one practice tradition to evaluate those of another one. But now coming to the question of what is the early Buddhist viewpoint on notions of permanence. And so there's two passages that came to my mind. The one is actually not a passage, it's a set of three verses in the Dhammapada, Dhammapada 277 and following. So the first one is Sabbe Sankhara Anicchati Yada Panyaya Passati Ata Nibbindati Dukke Esa Maggo Visuddhiya. So all sankharas, and I think here sankharas means anything conditioned. Anything conditioned is impermanent. When one sees that with wisdom, one gets disenchanted with what is dukkha. This is the path to purification. And we get the same for sabbe sankhara dukkati, all conditioned things are dukkha. And then we get sabbe dhamma anattati. So all phenomena are not self. And again, when one sees that with wisdom, one gets disenchanted with dukkha, and this is the path to purification or to purity. So we see that there's a difference being made between all formations for anicca and dukkha, but all dharmas for anatta. And my personal understanding is that this difference is meant for the final verse to include Nibbana itself. That even though of Nibbana we cannot say that it is anicca or dukkha, it is also anatta. But from an early Buddhist viewpoint, citta, the mind, vijnana, consciousness, they would all fall under what is condition and would be included in that most general sense of sankhara, which I think is relevant for this context as conditioned phenomena in general. However, some of those who see things in a different light, they sometimes would like to then argue that this statement on sankharas does not really include this original pure mind. I personally have reservations about this interpretation, but that is the way this argument sometimes proceeds. And then we get a similar or corresponding statement. So we have here this all conditioned things are impermanent. This is the path to develop wisdom and liberation. And then we get this statement in the Bahudadukha Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 115. Atanam etam anavakasa yang ditti sampanno pungalo kanchi sankharam nichyatu upagacchaya netam thanam vinjati. So this is a statement of what is impossible. This is a part of a longer list of impossibilities. And this is just impossible. It cannot be that a person who is endowed with view, ditti sampanno, this is a term that refers to the stream enterer, could approach any kind of sankhara, again the general sense of anything conditioned, as permanent. This is just impossible. And we get the same also for sankhara as approach it as sukkato, And then we get the same shift to Dhamma. Atanam etam anavakaso yang ditinti sampanna pogolo kanchi dhammang attatu upagacchaya netang thanan vinjati. So again, it is impossible, it cannot be that a person endowed with view would approach any dharma, any phenomena as self. That can't be. So we have the same situation here, and I would interpret it from an early Buddhist viewpoint here, sankhara, to have that very general sense of basically anything apart from Nibbana. That would then mean, on that interpretation, that it is impossible for a stream enterer to see anything as permanent, any mind or state of consciousness. And I would think that that is the interpretation that would suit this case. Anyhow, let us see what others like to comment on and say in the discussion that we will have in the forum. And a last comment, this is from Justin Brown. He had a very long entry, but in between there was this very beautiful little statement that almost makes me feel that I should just say that statement and stop the sermon. He says, "What would it be to sit simply in silence and allow the emptiness of the Dhamma to wash over this moment?" I thought that was very, very beautiful. And well, I will not let the emptiness wash over this moment, but continue with the sermon. So, etang santang etang panitang yadidang sabba sankhara samato sabbu padi padi nisango tanhangayo virago nirodo nippanam. This is peaceful, this is excellent, namely the stilling of all preparations, the relinquishment of all assets, the destruction of craving, detachment, cessation, extinction. With the permission of the Most Venerable Great Preceptor and the assembly of the Venerable Meditative Monks. This is the 14th sermon in this series of sermons on Nibbana. In our last sermon, we gave a description of the forms of imaginings or me-thinkings, which the Buddha had compared to an extremely subtle bondage of Mara. The Yava Kalapi Sutta of the Sallayatana Samyutta in the Samyutta Nikaya has shown us that all kinds of thoughts concerning existence that stem from this subtle conceit M, Asmimana, are mere imaginings or me-thinkings, and that they are called a bondage of Mara, because they have the power to keep beings shackled to existence. We have seen how they follow a dichotomy, even like the dilemma posed by the fivefold bondage of Vipachitti, the king of demons. Whether one thinks I shall be or I shall not be, one is in bondage to Mara. Whether one thinks I shall be percipient or I shall be non-percipient, or I shall be neither percipient nor non-percipient, one is still in bondage to Mara. There's a dichotomy involved here. The fact that these imaginings, which follow a dichotomy, must be transcended completely, as well as the way to transcend them, has been preached by the Buddha to Venerable Pukkhusati in the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya. There is a pithy passage forming the grand finale of this discourse, in which the Buddha gives a resume. We propose to quote this passage at the very outset, as it scintillates with a majestic fervor of the Dhamma. Yatantitang manyusava napavattanti manyusave kopana napavattamane muni santoti vuncetiti iti kopanetang vuntang kinchetang patichavuttang asmiti bhikkhu manyitang etang ayam ahang asmiti manyitam etang bhavisanti manyitametam, na bhavisanti manyitametam, rupi bhavisanti manyitametam, a rupi bhavisanti manyitametam, sanyi bhavisanti manyitametam, asanyi bhavisanti manyitametam, Nivasanyi naasanyi bhavisanti manyidametam. Manyidam bhikkhu rogo, manyidam gando, manyidam sallam. Sabba manyitanam tveva bhikkhu samatikkama muni santoti ujjati. Muni kopana bhikkhu santo na jayati, na jayati, na meyati, na kupati, na piyati. Tambhisa bhikkhu natantiyena jayata, ajaya mano king jayasati, ajiya mano king miyasati, amiya mano king kuppisati, akuppa mano kissapi hesati. Yattantitang manyusava nampatvantanti, manyusave kopana nampavattamane, muni santoti vujjatiti, iti yantang vuttang, idametam paticca vuttam. In the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, we find the Buddha presenting some points as the theme and gradually developing it, analyzing, clarifying and expatiating as the discourse proceeds. The opening sentence in the above paragraph is a quotation of a part of that original statement of the Buddha, which forms the theme. Here is the rendering. Steadied whereon the tides of imaginings no longer occur in him, and when the tides of imaginings occur no more in him, he is called a sage stilled. So it was said. And with reference to what was this said? Am monks is something imagined. I am this is something imagined. I shall be is something imagined. I shall not be is something imagined. I shall be possessed of form is something imagined. I shall be formless is something imagined. I shall be percipient is something imagined. I shall be non-percipient is something imagined. I shall be neither percipient nor non-percipient is something imagined. The imagined is a disease. The imagined is an abscess. The imagined is a dart. It is with the surmounting of all what is imagined, monk, that a sage is called stilled. The sage who is stilled is not born, nor does he age, nor does he die, nor is he shaken, and he has no longing. Even that is not in him, whereby he might be born. Not being born, how shall he age? Not aging, how shall he die? Not dying, how shall he be shaken? Being unshaken, what shall he long for? So it was with reference to this that it was said, steadied whereon the tides of imaginings no longer occur in him. And when the tides of imagining occur no more in him, he is called a sage stilled. Comment, translation by Nyanamoli. The tides of conceiving do not sweep over one who stands upon these foundations. And when the tides of conceiving no longer sweep over him, he is called a sage at peace. So it was said. And with reference to what was this said? Bhikkhu, I am is a conceiving. I am this is a conceiving. I shall be is a conceiving. I shall not be is a conceiving. I shall be possessed of form is a conceiving. I shall be formless is a conceiving. I shall be percipient is a conceiving. I shall be non-percipient is a conceiving. I shall be neither percipient nor non-percipient is a conceiving. Conceiving is a disease. Conceiving is a tumor. Conceiving is a dart. By overcoming all conceivings, bhikkhu, one is called a sage at peace. And the sage at peace is not born, does not age, does not die. He is not shaken and does not yearn. For there is nothing present in him by which he might be born. Not being born, how could he age? Not aging, how could he die? Not dying, how could he be shaken? Not being shaken, why should he yearn? So it was with reference to this that it was said, the tides of conceiving do not sweep over one who stands upon these foundations. And when the tides of conceiving no longer sweep over him, he is called a sage at peace. And here is the relevant passage from the Madhyama Agama. Monk, I am elevates oneself. I shall be also elevates oneself. I shall neither be nor not be also elevates oneself. I shall be endowed with form also elevates oneself. I shall be formless also elevates oneself. I shall be neither endowed with form nor formless also elevates oneself. I shall be percipient also elevates oneself. I shall be non-percipient also elevates oneself. I shall be neither percipient nor non-percipient also elevates oneself. This is conceit. This is pride. This is negligence. Monk, if there is none of this self-elevation, conceit, pride or negligence, then the mind is reckoned to be at peace. Monk, if the mind is at peace, then it does not dislike, is not sad, is not troubled, not agitated. Why is that? Because that monk has attained the Dharma. There is no longer what could be called dislike. Not disliking, he is not sad. Not being sad, he is not worried. Not being worried, he is not troubled. Not being troubled, he is not agitated. And because of not being agitated, he attains Nirvana. Knowing as it really is, birth is ended, the holy life has been established. What had to be done has been done. There will not be another experience of existence. And the Tibetan parallel has a passage even more closely corresponding to the description in the Dhatavibhanga Sutta concerning not being born and not aging, which is not found in the Chinese. And you can find more information on that in my habilitation, page 800, note 210. End of comment. All this goes to show how relevant the question of imaginings is to the path leading to Nibbana. This pithy passage, which brings the discourse to a climax, portrays how the sage is at peace when his mind is released by stemming the tides of imaginings. He attains release from birth, decay and death, here and now, because he has realized the cessation of existence in this very world. It is in this light that we have to interpret the above statement, even that is not in him whereby he might be born. Dependent on existence is birth. Due to whatever postulate of existence, one can speak of a birth, even that existence is not in him. Not being born, how can he age? How can he grow old or decay? This is because of the implicit interrelation between conditions. Here we can flash back to our analogy of a tree mentioned earlier. In order to explain the mutual interrelation between the concepts of birth, decay and death, we brought up a simile, which however is not canonical. That is to say, supposing there is some kind of a tree, the buds, the leaves, the flowers, the fruits and the wood of which could be sold for making one's livelihood. If five men trading in those items respectively are made to line up at some particular stage in the growth of this tree, and asked whether the tree is too young or too old, the answers given might differ according to the individual standpoint grasped in each case. It turns out to be a difference of viewpoint. For instance, the man who makes his living by selling the buds would reply that the tree is too old when the buds turn into leaves. Similarly, when it is the season for the leaves to fall and the flowers to bloom, one who trades in leaves might say that the tree is too old. And when flowers turn into fruits, the florist's viewpoint would be similar. In this way, one can understand how this concept changes according to what one grasps, that there is an implicit relativity about it. Now, as for this sage, he has given up everything that he had grasped. Grasping has been given up completely. Imagining too has been abandoned. Hence, not being born, how shall he age? The sage has no postulate of existence. Since there is no existence, there is no birth. Because there is no birth, there is no decay. It is a well-known fact that the term jara implies both growth and decay. It is after setting a limit that we speak of a process of decay, after growth. This limit, however, varies according to our individual standpoint grasped, according to our point of view. That is what we have tried to illustrate by this analogy. Then we have the statement, not aging, how shall he die? Since decay is an approach to death, where there is no decay, there is no death. The fact that there is no death, we have already seen in our exposition of the significance of the verses quoted above from the Adimutta Tirthagata. When the bandits got round to kill the Venerable Adimutta, he declared, Name hosi, name hoti ahosinti, bhavissanti nahoti me, sankhara vibhavissanti tattaka paridivana. It does not occur to me I was, nor does it occur to me I shall be. Mere preparations will get destroyed. What is there to lament? Comment, translation by Norman. I do not have the thought I have been, nor do I have the thought I shall be. The constituent elements will cease to exist. What lamentation will there be in respect of that? End of comment. This declaration exemplifies the above statement. When all graspings are given up, there is no decay or death. Amiyamano king kuppisati, not dying, how shall he be shaken? The verb kuppati does not necessarily mean getting annoyed. Here it means to be shaken up or moved. When one holds on to a standpoint, one gets shaken up if someone else tries to dislodge him from that standpoint. The deliverance in Nibbana is called akuppa citta vimutti, the unshakable deliverance of the mind. All other deliverances of the mind known to the world are shakable, kuppa, they are unsteady. They shake before the pain of death. Only Nibbana is called akuppa citta vimutti, the unshakable deliverance of the mind. So this peaceful sage, the Arahant, established in that concentration of the fruit of Arahatta Palasamadhi, which is known as the influx-free deliverance of the mind, Anasava Cheto Vimutti, and is endowed with the wisdom proper to Arahanthut, Panya Vimutti, deliverance through wisdom, is unshaken before death. His mind remains unshaken. That is why the Arahantera, Venerable Adimutta, fearlessly made the above declaration to the bandits. Now as to the significance of the Buddha's statement, Amiyamano kinkuppisati, akuppamano kissapihesati, not dying, how shall he be shaken? And being unshaken, what shall he long for? When there is no shock, no agitation or trembling, what does one long for? Piha means longing, desiring for something or other. In this context, it refers to that longing which arises at the moment of death in one who has not destroyed craving. It is as a consequence of that longing that he enters some form of existence, according to his karma. That longing is not there in this age, for the simple reason that he is unshaken before death. He has nothing to look forward to, no desires or longings. Akuppamano kissapihesati, being unshaken, what shall he long for? It is obvious, therefore, that the concepts of birth, decay and death become meaningless to this sage. That is precisely why he is at peace, having transcended all imaginings. All this goes to show that Nibbana is a state beyond decay and death. We can clearly understand from this discourse why Nibbana is known as the decayless, deathless state, realizable in this very world. That sage has conquered decay and death here and now, because he has realized the cessation of existence here and now. This is something extremely wonderful about the Arahant. He realizes the cessation of existence in his attainment to the fruit of Arahanthood. How does he come to realize the cessation of existence? Craving is extinct in him. Hence, there is no grasping. When there is no grasping, there is no existence. Because there is no existence, birth, decay and death along with sorrow and lamentation, cease altogether. From the foregoing, we could well infer that all those concepts like birth, decay, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair come about as a result of a heap of pervert perceptions, pervert thoughts, and pervert views, based on the conceit of an existence, the conceit M. These three kinds of perversions, known as sanya vipallasa, citta vipallasa, and ditti vipallasa, give rise to a mass of concepts of an imaginary nature. The entire mass of suffering, summed up by the terms birth, decay, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, are basically of a mental origin. For an illustration of this fact, we can go back to our analogy of winding some strands into a rope mentioned earlier. We pointed out that in the case of some strands that are being mistakenly wound in the same direction, it is the grasp in the middle that gives at least a semblance of a rope to it. So long as there is no such grasping, the strands do not become knotty or tense, as they go round and round. It is only when someone grasps it in the middle that the strands begin to get winded up, knotty and tense. What is called existence or becoming, bhava, follows the same norm. True to the law of impermanence, everything in the world changes. But there is something innocent in this change. Impermanence is innocuous in itself. We say it is innocuous because it means no harm to anyone. It is simply the nature of this world, the suchness, the norm. It can do us harm only when we grasp, just as in the case of that quasi-rope. The tenseness between winding and unwinding, arising out of that grasp in the middle, is comparable to what is called bhava-sankhara, preparations for existence. Sankhara, or preparations, are said to be dependent on avidya, or ignorance. Now we can form an idea of the relationship between these two, even from this analogy of the rope. The grasp in the middle creates two ends, giving rise to a dilemma. In the case of existence, too, grasping leads to an antinomian conflict. To become a thing is to disintegrate into another thing. On a previous occasion, we happened to discuss the significance of the term manyana, me-thinking or imagining, with reference to the verse yena yena hi manyanti tatatang hoti anyata. Manyana itself gives rise to a thing, which from its very inception goes on disintegrating into another thing. Just as much as grasping leads to the concept of two ends, to become a thing is to start changing into another thing. That is, it comes under the sway of the law of impermanence. Illustrations of this norm are sometimes to be met with in the discourses, but their significance is often ignored. The idea of the two ends and the middle sometimes finds expression in reference to an above, below, and a cross in the middle. Uddang adho tiriyam manje, or in the terms before, behind, and middle, pure paccha manje. Such references deal with some deep aspects of the Dhamma relating to Nibbana. As a good illustration, we may take up the following two verses from the Mettagu Manavaputcha in the Parayana Vanga of the Sutta Nipata. Yankinchi sampajanasi uddang ado tiryang chapi manje etisunandincha nivesanancha panujya vinyanam bhavena titte evam vihari satuapamattu Mingo charang hitva mamaitani jati jarang soka parindavancha ideva vidva pajaheya dukkham. Whatever you may know to be above, below, and across in the middle, dispel the delight and the tendency to dwell in them. Then your consciousness will not remain in existence. A monk endowed with understanding, thus dwelling mindful and heedful, as he fares along, giving up all possessions, would abandon even here and now birth, decay, sorrow, lamentation, and suffering. Comment. Translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Whatever you comprehend, Metta Guru, said the Blessed One, above, below, and across in the middle, having dispelled delight and attachment to these, consciousness would not persist in existence. The bhikkhu saw dwelling, mindful, heedful, having given up taking things as mine. Right here, such a wise one might abandon suffering, birth, old age, sorrow, and lamenting. End of comment. The word ideva, occurring in the second verse, is highly significant, in that it means the abandonment of all those things here and now, not leaving it for an existence to come. In the Mahavyuha Sutta of the Sutta Nipata, also similar emphasis is laid on this idea of here and now. About the Arahant, it is said that he has no death or birth here and now. Chatupapato ida yasa natti, to whom even here there is no death or birth. In this very world, he has transcended them by making those two concepts meaningless. The word nivesanam, occurring in the first verse, is also significant. It means dwelling. In consciousness, there is a tendency to dwell in. That is why in some contexts it is said that form is the abode or dwelling place of consciousness. Rupa dhatu ko ghapati vinyanasa oko. The form element household is the abode of consciousness. The terms oka, niketa, and nivesana are synonyms, meaning home, abode, home, or dwelling place. The nature of consciousness in general is to abide or dwell in. That non-manifestative consciousness, anidasana vijnana, however, has got rid of the tendency to abide or dwell in. Now we can revert to the passage in the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, which speaks of an occurrence of tides of imaginings. The passage actually begins with the word yattatitam manyusava na pavattanti, steadied whereon the tides of imaginings occur no more in him. The idea behind this occurrence of tides of imaginings is quite often represented by the concept of asava, influx. Sensuality, karma, existence, bhava, views, ditti, and ignorance, avidya, are referred to as influxes, asava, or floods, or gha. These are the four kinds of samsaric habits that continuously flow into the minds of beings. Comment here, the four asavas are found only in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, and they are also only in the PTS edition, not in the Asian editions. So that seems to be a slightly later development, and we otherwise just get three asavas mentioned in the Pali discourses and their parallels. And the one on views is not mentioned. And you can find more information on this in my habilitation, page 382, note 217. And also, for those who like to follow up the topic of asavas, I have discussed it in an article that we will be making available on the website, The Purification, Early Buddhist Doctrine and Buddhist Ethics, where starting on page 80, I discuss some of the views by some scholars on asavas, and which I try to rectify and clarify. End of comment. The above-mentioned sutta passage refers to a place steadied whereon the tides of imaginings do not occur or flow in, a place that is free from their influence. This is none other than Nibbana, for which one of the epithets used is deeper or island. Since Nibbana is called an island, some might take it literally to mean some sort of a place in this world. In fact, this is the general concept of Nibbana some are prone to uphold in their interpretation of Nibbana. But why it is called an island is clearly explained for us by a discourse in the Parayana Vanga of the Sutta Nipata, namely the Kappa Manava Puccha. In this sutta, the Brahmin youth Kappa poses the following question to the Buddha. Manjhe Sarasmin Tittatam Omhe Jati Mahabhaye Jarama Chuparitanam Deepam Pabruhi Marisam Tanchame Deepam Akankahi Yathaidam Naparamsiyam. To them that stand midstream, when the frightful floods flow forth, to them in decay and death forlorn, an island, sire, may you proclaim, an island which none else excels. Yea, such an isle, pray tell me, sire. And this is the Buddha's reply to it. Akinchanam anadanam etam deepam anaparam Nibbanam iti nang brumi jarama jumaparinkayam. Owning not, grasping not, the isle is this and none else besides. Nibbana, that is how I call that isle, wherein decay is decayed and death is dead. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. For those standing in the midst of the stream, said the Venerable Kappa, when a perilous flood has arisen, for those oppressed by old age and death, declare an island, dear sir. Explain to me the island, so this might occur no more. Owning nothing, taking nothing, this is the island with nothing further. I call this Nibbana, the extinction of old age and death. End of comment. The Buddha's reply makes it clear that the term Nibbana stands for the extinction of craving and grasping. The idea of owning naught and grasping naught is itself Nibbana and nothing else. If the term had any other connotation, the Buddha would have mentioned it in this context. It is indubitably clear then that this epithet Deepam or island has to be understood in a deeper sense when it refers to Nibbana. It is that owning nothing and grasping nothing that puts an end to decay and death. Though we have yet to finish the discussion on the Dhatavibhanga Sutta, the stage is already set now to understand the significance of a certain brief discourse in the Udana, which is very often quoted in discussions on Nibbana. For facility of understanding, we shall take it up now, as it somehow fits into the context. Atanti bhikkave ajatam abhutam akatam asankatam. Nochitang bhikkave abhavissa ajatam abhutam akatam asankatam. Naida jatasya bhutasya katasya sankatasya nisaran panyayata. Yasmachako bhikkave atthi ajatam abhutam akatam asankatam. Tasma jatasya bhutasya katasya sankatasya nisaran panyayati. Monks, they are not born, are not become, are not made, are not compounded. Monks, if that not born, not become, not made, not compounded were not, there would be no stepping out here from what is born, become, made and compounded. But since monks, there is a not born, a not become, a not made, a not compounded, therefore there is stepping out from what is born, become, made and compounded. Common translation by Ireland. This because are not born, are not brought to being, are not made, are not formed. If because they were not born, not brought to being, not made, not formed, no escape would be discerned from what is born, brought to being, made, formed. But since they are not born, are not brought to being, are not made, are not formed, therefore an escape is discerned from what is born, brought to being, made and formed. Yeah, and I wanted to mention that this very powerful and beautiful passage, we have no parallel. In fact, the whole section on Nibbana in the Udana, these first four discourses, we don't have a counterpart in the Chinese Udana collection. Nor do we have a counterpart to the Bahya story, to which we will be coming later in this sermon. And I wanted to mention that this is in itself understandable to some extent due to the different developments of the Udana collections. So I think we should not make too much out of the absence of a parallel. It certainly means that the it would be a stronger situation if we had parallels, but because of the whole history of the development of this particular textual collection, it is not surprising that we don't have parallels. And for anybody who would like to follow this up, which is perhaps not of such direct interest for those who are more interested in the content, but more for those who are interested in the history and development of early Buddhist oral tradition, there's another article of mine that we'll be making available, the development of the Pali Udana collection, in which I discuss this whole development in more detail, which gives a little bit of a background. But the basic point is simply that, yes, we don't have a parallel, but this doesn't necessarily mean that the passage we have in Pali is, for this very reason, not to be taken serious. End of comment. The terms ajatam, not born, abhutam, not become, akatam, not made, and asankatam, not compounded, are all epithets for Nibbana. The Buddha declares that if not for this, not born, not become, not made, not compounded, there would be no possibility of stepping out of release here, that is, in this very world, from the born, the become, the made, and the compounded. The second half of the passage rhetorically reiterates and emphasizes the same fact. Now, as to the significance of this profound declaration of the Buddha, we may point out that the terms not born, not become, not made, not compounded suggest the emancipation of the Arahant's mind from birth, becoming, and preparation, sankhara. They refer to the cessation of birth, becoming, and preparations realized by the Arahant. So then the significance of these terms is purely psychological. But the commentator, the Venerable Dhammapala, pays little attention to the word ida here in this passage, which needs to be emphasized. The fact that there is a possibility here and now of stepping out from the state of being born, become, made, and compounded surely deserves emphasis, since until then, release from decay and death was thought to be possible only in another dimension of existence, that is, after death. The prospect of stepping out from decay and death here and now, in this very world, has to be asserted for its novelty, which is why the declaration opens with the word ati, there is. However, most of the scholars who try to interpret this passage in their discussion on Nibbana, instead of laying stress on the word ida, here, emphasize the opening word ati, there is, to prove that Nibbana is some form of reality absolutely existing somewhere. As that passage from the Dhatuvibhanga Sutta on Manyana, which we discussed, has shown us, the terms ajatam, abhutam, akatam, and asankatam have to be understood in a deeper sense. Existence is a conceit deep-rooted in the mind, which gives rise to a heap of pervert notions. Its cessation, therefore, has also to be accomplished in the mind and by the mind. This is the gist of the Buddha's exhortation. Let us now come back to the Dhatuvibhanga Sutta to discuss another facet of it. We started our discussion with the grand finale of that discourse because of its relevance to the question of Manyana. However, as a matter of fact, this discourse preached by the Buddha to the Venerable Pukkusati is an exposition of a systematic path of practice for the emancipation of the mind from imaginings, or manyana. The discourse begins with the declaration, Cha dhātaroyam bhikkhu puriso. Monk man as such is a combination of six elements. The whirling things that a being, sattva, Sanskrit sattva, exists at a higher level of reality than inanimate objects. Now, what did the Buddha do to explore this concept of a being in his discourse to Venerable Pukkusati? He literally trashed out that concept by breaking up this man into his basic elements and defining him as a bundle of six elements, namely earth, water, fire, air, space, and consciousness. As the discourse proceeds, he explains in an extremely lucid manner how one can detach one's mind from each of these elements. We happen to mention at the very outset that the depth of the Dhamma has to be seen through lucidity and not through complicated overdrawings. In fact, this discourse exhibits such lucidity. The meditation subject of elements, which grew in complexity at the hands of later Buddhist philosophers, who took to atomistic analysis of a speculative sort, is presented here in this Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta with a refreshing clarity and lucidity. Here it is explained in such a way that one can directly experience it. For instance, in describing the earth element, the Buddha gives as examples of the internal earth element such parts of the body as head hairs, body hairs, nails and teeth. Because the external earth element hardly needs illustration, nothing in particular has been mentioned as to that aspect. Anyone can easily understand what is meant by it. There is no attempt at atomistic analysis. However, the Buddha draws special attention to a certain first principle of great significance. Ya cheva kopana ajhattika patavidhatu, ya cha bahira patavidhatu, patavidhatu revesa, tam netam mama nesuam asmi, namiso attati eva metam yatha bhutam sammam panyaya dattabham. Eva metam yatha bhutam sammam panyaya disva, patavidhatuya nibbindati, patavidhatuya chittam virajati. That which is the internal earth element and that which is the external earth element, they are both just the earth element itself. And that should be seen as it is with right wisdom, thus, this is not mine, I am not this, this is not myself. Having seen thus with right wisdom as it is, he becomes dejected with the earth element. He detaches his mind from the earth element. Comment. Translation by Jnanamoli. Now, both the internal earth element and the external earth element are simply earth element. And that should be seen as he actually is, with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees it thus as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the earth element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the earth element. And here the Madhyama Agama parallel. Monk, whatever is the internal earth element and whatever is the external earth element, all of that is collectively called the earth element. All of it is not mine, I am not that, and it is not myself. On wisely contemplating it like this, knowing it as it really is, the mind does not become defiled with attachment in regard to this earth element. End of comment. It is this first principle that is truly important and not any kind of atomic theory. This resolution of the internal-external conflict has in it the secret of stopping the samsaric vortex of reiterated becoming, samsaravatta. It is due to the very discrimination between an internal and an external that the samsaric vortex is kept going. Now, in the case of a vortex, what is found inside and outside is simply water. But all the same, there is such a vehement speed and activity and a volley of changes going on there. So it is the case with this man. What is found in his body is the earth element. What is to be found outside is also the earth element. And yet, the ordinary person sees quite a wide disparity between the two. Why is that? That is because of the illusory nature of consciousness. We have devoted a number of sermons to explain the relationship between consciousness and name and form. We happen to speak of name and form as a reflection or a self-image. Even as one who comes before a mirror on seeing his reflection in it would say, "This is mine, this am I, this is myself." The worldling is in the habit of entertaining cravings, conceits, and views. In fact, the purpose of cravings, conceits, and views is to reinforce the distinction between an internal and an external. Already when one says, this is mine, one discriminates between the this and I, taking them to be separate realities. This am I and this is myself betray the same tacit assumption. Just as by looking at a mirror one may like or dislike the image appearing on it, these three points of view give rise to various pervert notions. All this because of the perpetuation of the distinction between an internal and an external, which is the situation with the ordinary worldling. Since cravings, conceits and views thus reinforce the dichotomy between an internal and an external, the Buddha has upheld this principle underlying the meditation on the four elements to resolve this conflict. The fact that with the resolution of this conflict between the internal and the external concerning the four elements, the mind becomes emancipated is put across to us in the following verse in the Thala Puttathera Gatha. Kadanu katte cha tine lata cha khande imeham amite cha dhamme achati kancheva cha bahirani cha samang tuleyam tadiram kadame. This verse gives expression to Venerable Thala Puttathera's aspiration to become an arahant. It says, when shall I weigh as equal all these limitless things, both internal and external, twigs, grass, creepers, and these aggregates? Oh, when shall that be for me? Comment, translation by Norman. When shall I regard as no more than wood and grass and creepers, these elements of existence and innumerable mental phenomena, both internal and external things? When will this thought of mine be? End of comment. It is at the stage of arahanthood that the internal and the external appear alike. That is precisely why the Venerable Adimuttathera, whom we quoted earlier, uttered the lines, Tinna katta samang lokang yada panyaya passati. When one sees through wisdom the world to be comparable to grass and twigs. Comment, translation by Norman. When by wisdom one sees the world as being like grass and wood. End of comment. The comparison is between the internal world of the five aggregates, or this conscious body, and the inanimate objects outside. Just as in the case of the four elements earth, water, fire and air, the Buddha pointed out a way of liberating one's mind from the space element with the help of similar illustrations. In explaining the space element too, he gave easily intelligible examples. The internal space element is explained in terms of some apertures in the body that are well known, namely those in the ears, nose and the mouth. Apart from such instances, he did not speak of any microscopic space element, as in scientific explanations, probably because it is irrelevant. Such an analysis is irrelevant for this kind of reflection. Here we have to bear in mind the fact that perception as such is a mirage. However far one may go on analyzing, form and space are relative to each other, like a picture and its background. A picture is viewed against its background, which is relative to it. So also are these two concepts of form and space. Consciousness provides the framework for the entire picture. By way of clarification, we may allude to the pre-Buddhistic attempts of yogins to solve this problem solely through the method of serenity, samatha, ignoring the method of insight, vipassana. The procedure they followed was somewhat on these lines. They would first of all surmount the concept of form or matter through the first four mental absorptions or jhanas. Then, as they inclined towards the formless, what confronted them first was space. A very appropriate illustration in this context would be the method of removing the sign of the casino and attending to the space left by that removal as infinite or boundless in order to arouse the base of infinity of space. This mode of contemplation of space betrays the fact that space is also something made up or prepared, sankhata. Whatever is prepared, sankhata, is thought out and mind made, avisankhatam, avisanchitaitam. The Buddha proclaimed that there is only one sankhata, unprepared, that is Nibbana. But later philosophers confronted the issue by taking space also to be a sankhata. may seem to have ignored its relation to the mind in regarding causes and conditions as purely external things. Comment? Yeah, I just wanted to mention that in the Katavatum, this is part of the Abhidhamma collection, according to the Katavatu, the space should not be reckoned as either conditioned or as unconditioned. And in the Milindapanya, Nagasena considers space not to be the product of conditions. End of comment. Here we see the relativity between form and space. Like the picture in its background, form and space stand relative to each other. All this is presented to us by attention. Manasikara sambhava sambe dhamma. All things originate from attention. Some of the later speculations about the nature of the space element are not in consonance with the basic principles outlined in the Dhamma. Such confusion arose probably due to a lack of understanding of the term Asankhata. Now, if we are to say something more about this particular discourse, what remains after detaching one's mind from these five elements, namely earth, water, fire, air, and space, is a consciousness that is extremely pure. The basic function of consciousness is discrimination. It distinguishes between the bitter and the sweet, for instance, to say this is bitter, this is sweet, or else it distinguishes between the pleasant, the unpleasant, and the neutral with regard to feelings. This is pleasant, this is unpleasant, this is neither unpleasant nor pleasant. Comment, yeah, I just wanted to show these two passages of Vijanati, Vijanati, Tiko Abu Sotasma Vinyanam Tibuchadi, it's the first. And Jnanamoli translates it as it cognizes, friend. That is why consciousness is said. And the second passage from the Samyutta Nikaya, Vijanati tiko bhikkave tasma vijnananti vunchadi. And Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as it cognizes because, therefore it is called consciousness. In the Vijanati, the verb is basically just the verbal form of the noun vijnana. And so one can even say it is being conscious, therefore it is called consciousness. And I find this, I just wanted to mention this because we need to distinguish between vijnana and sanya. Sanya perception is the part of the mind that recognizes, that gives us that knowing input, this is such a thing. But vijnana is more this kind of like receptive knowing of the whole mental experience. Both are forms of jnā, of knowing, and they obviously collaborated, but there is this subtle distinction between the contribution made of these two jnās, jnānas, these two knowledges to our mental experience. End of comment. Now that the five elements, earth, water, fire, air, and space, which create discrete objects as the outward manifestations of consciousness, have been totally removed, the residual function of consciousness amounts to a discrimination between the three grades of feelings. The sage who has arrived at this stage of progress on the path to Nibbana takes the next step by observing these three kinds of feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, and neither unpleasant nor pleasant, as they arise and cease, dependent on specific contexts, thereby gradually bringing the mind to equanimity. He brings his mind to a stage of radiant equanimity, but even this equanimity he does not grasp by way of mere thinking or imagining. The phrase used in this connection is visangyutto nang videti, being detached, he experiences it. There's a detachment, an aloofness, even in going through those sensations. This is clearly expressed in that context. For instance, in the case of a pleasant feeling, it is said anicchati pajanati, anajositati pajanati, annabhinanditati pajanati. He understands it to be impermanent. He understands it to be uninvolved. He understands it to be unrejoiced. With the understanding of impermanence, conceit goes down. The non-involvement does away with abuse. The absence of rejoicing suggests the extinction of craving. So the attainment of Arahanthood is in effect the cessation of that consciousness itself. That consciousness is divested of its most primary function of discriminating between the three grades of feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, and neither unpleasant nor pleasant. The term visangyutto connotes disjunction, suggestive of dispassion and detachment. In this way, the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta clearly brings out the relevance of the question of manyana to the path leading to nibbana. In some contexts, this practice of desisting from me-thinking or imagining is called attammayata, non-identification. This is the term used by the Buddha throughout the Sampurisa Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya. For instance, we read there, Sampuriso chako bhikkhave iti patisanchikkhati Niva sanya na sanya yatana samapatiya bhikkhu attammayata buddha bhagavata Yena yena hi manyanti tatotan hoti anyatati. The good man reflects thus, the principle of non-identification has been recommended by the Buddha even with regard to the attainment of the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception thus. In whatever way they imagine about it, thereby it turns otherwise. Comment and translation by Nyanamoli. But a true man considers thus, non-identification even with the attainment of the base of neither perception nor non-perception has been declared by the Blessed One. For in whatever way they conceive, the fact is ever other than that. End of comment. The good man referred to here is the noble disciple on the supramundane path. This term tammaya needs to be clarified in order to understand the significance of this statement. It is derived from tatmaya, literally made of that or of that stuff. It is on a par with such terms as savanna maya, golden, or rajata maya, silvery. When one has cravings, conceits and views about something, he practically becomes one with it due to that very grasping. In other words, he identifies himself with it. That is why the person who has imaginings about the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception, which he has attained, thinks, I am one who has attained the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. He thereby has conceit, which is a defilement in itself. As a result, when he loses his mastery of that attainment, he becomes disconcerted. It is for that reason that the Buddha had enjoined that one should cultivate the attitude of attammayata or non-identification, even with regard to the attainment of the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. The Arahant is called attammayo, in the sense that he does not identify himself with anything. An Arahant cannot be identified with what he appears to possess. This is well expressed by the following verse in the Devadutta Bhaga of the Anguttara Nikaya. Pasaiha marang abhibhuyantakam yochapusi jatikkhayang padhanava sotari so loka vidusumedho sabbeso dhammeso attammayoni. That ardent sage who has touched the extinction of birth, having overpowered Mara and conquered the ender, that such like one the wise sage, the knower of the world, is aloof in regard to all phenomena. Common translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Having vanquished Mara and overcome the end-maker, the striver has finished with birth. Such a sage, wise, world-knower, identifies with nothing at all. End of comment. The idea of this aloofness can be presented in another way, that is, as detachment from the seen, the heard, the sensed, and the cognized. Ditta, sutta, mutta, vinyata. One of the most important suttas that merits discussion in this respect is the Bhaya Sutta in the Bodhi Vagga of the Udana. It is generally acclaimed as an extremely profound discourse. The ascetic Bahya Dharvacharyam came all the way from far off Subhaparaka to see the Buddha. When he reached Jetavana Monastery at Savatthi, he heard that the Buddha had just left on his arms round. Due to his extreme eagerness, he ran behind the Buddha and on meeting him fell prostrate before him and begged, May the Exalted One preach to me the Dhamma. comment. Yeah, I just wanted to mention that in the original, Bhai is not described as running behind the Buddha, but it is clear that he was very keen to meet the Buddha, since he did not wait at Jeta's grove. End of comment. The Buddha, however, seemed not so responsive when he remarked, "Now it is untimely, Bhaiya. We are on our arms round." Some might be puzzled by this attitude of the Buddha, but most probably it is one of those skillful means of the Buddha, suggestive of his great compassion and wisdom. It served to tone down the over-enthusiastic haste of Bhaiya and to arouse a reverential respect for the Dhamma in him. Comment again, I'm not sure whether Bhaiya was really hasty. It's just that he didn't want to wait at Jeta's grove and follow the Buddha into town because he had been walking all over half of India to meet him. So I think he was very enthusiastic, but I'm not sure if he was behaving in a hasty manner. The way he's being described in the sutta as being considered an arahant by many in the region where he was living and presumably an attainer of all eight samapattis, the whole range of tranquility attainments, makes it, in my view, improbable that he would act in a hasty manner and run around. End of comment. Bhaiya repeated his request for the second time, adding, "I do not know whether there will be a danger to the Exalted One's life or to my own life." For the second time, the Buddha refused. It was when Bhaiya made his request for the third time that the Buddha acceded to it by giving a terse discourse, Sankhita Dhamma Desana, of extraordinary depth. The exhortation, brief and deep as it is, was quite apt, since Bhaiya Dharmacariya belonged to that rare category of persons with quick understanding, Kipabhinya. Tasmatiyate Bhaiya evang singkitambam. Nitte dittamattam bhavisati, sutte sutamattam bhavisati, mutte mutamattam bhavisati, vinyata vinyatamattam bhavisati. Evang ite Bhaiya singkitambam. Yatukote Bhaiya ditte dittamattang bhavissati, sutte sutamattang bhavissati, mutte muttamattang bhavissati, vinyate vinyatamattang bhavissati, tatutvang Bhaiya natena. Yatutvang Bhaiya natena, tatutvang Bhaiya natatta. Yatutvang Bhaiya natatta, tatutvang Bhaiya nevida, nahurang, naubhaiya mantarena. Ese vantaduk rasa. No sooner had the Buddha finished his exhortation, the ascetic Bhaiya attained arahanthood then and there. Let us now try to unravel the meaning of this abstruse discourse. The discourse starts off abruptly, as if it had been wrested from the Buddha by Bhaiya's repeated requests. Tasmatiya Bhaiya evang sikkitambam. Well then, Bhaiya, you had better train yourself thus. And what is that training? In the seen, there will be just the seen. In the heard, there will be just the heard. In the sensed, there will be just the sensed. In the cognized, there will be just the cognized. Thus, Bhaiya, should you train yourself. Comment, translation by Ireland. In the seen will be merely what is seen. In the heard will be merely what is heard. In the sensed will be merely what is sensed. In the cognized will be merely what is cognized. In this way, you should train yourself, Bhaiya. End of comment. It is as if the Buddha had addressed the ascetic Bhaiya in the terminology of the Aryans and established him on the path to Nibbana. Here the term mutta, or sensed, stands for whatever is experienced through the tongue, the nose and the body. The basic principle in this training seems to be the discipline to stop short at bare awareness, ditte dittamattam, sutte sutamattam, etc. The latter half of the discourse seems to indicate what happens when one goes through that training. The entire discourse is a presentation of the triple training of morality, concentration and wisdom in a nutshell. And when to your Bhaiya, there will be in the seen just the seen, in the heard just the heard, in the sensed just the sensed, in the cognized just the cognized, then Bhaiya, you are not by it. And when you are not by it, you are not in it. And when Bhaiya, you are not in it, then Bhaiya, you are neither here, nor there, nor in between. This itself is the end of suffering. Comment, translation by Ireland. When Bhaiya in the seen is merely what is seen, in the heard is merely what is heard, in the sensed is merely what is sensed, in the cognized, this mainly what is cognized, then bhaya, you will not be with that. When bhaya, you are not with that, then bhaya, you will not be in that. When bhaya, you are not in that, then bhaya, you will be neither here nor beyond, nor in between the two. Just this is the end of suffering, end of comment. As a literal translation, this appears cryptic enough to demand an explanation. Let us first of all give a few clues to unravel the puzzle. The terms by it, tena, and in it, tatta, are rather elliptical. Though unexpressed, they seem to imply the relevance of manyana to the whole problem. As we happened to mention earlier, imaginings or mere thinkings by way of craving, conceit and views lead to an identification for which the term used is tammaya, tattammayata. Such an identification makes one unsteady, for when the thing identified with is shaken, one also gets shaken up. This kind of imagining in terms of is indicated by the elliptical tena. For we get a clear proof of it in the following two lines from the Jara Sutta in the Attaka Vagga of the Sutta Nipada. Dono nahi tena manyate yaridang ditta sutang mutesuva. Dhona is a term for the Arahant, as one who has shaken off all defilements. Though these lines could be rendered as follows. The Arahant, the one who has shaken off, doesn't imagine in terms of whatever is seen, heard and sensed. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi, one cleans does not thereby conceive things seen, heard, or sensed. Thank you very much for your attention.